This is Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear how schools are failing to do enough to protect victims of sexual assault and harassment.
This is a problem that's existed probably forever. Even with the Me Too movement, there's a lot of victim blaming and there's a lot of just not believing people. And I think that that is exasperated for children and youth.
Also, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan joins us to discuss her investigation into clergy abuse. Walmart has been blamed for the demise of Main Street, but what happens when Walmart leaves a small town?
There is really a void. Many of those mom-and-pop shops that were there 40 and 50 years ago are no longer there. Walmart leaves, and so there's this emptiness.
Stay with us for Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. Plenty ahead this hour. We'll find out why some say schools aren't doing enough when it comes to dealing with sexual assault cases. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan talks to us about clergy abuse and what she's found with her investigation. And a U of I researcher has been looking at climate change and the impact right here in Illinois. We'll have his takeaway. All ahead this hour. First up today, two small towns in rural Illinois recently lost their Walmart stores. 3 decades after the retail giant came in and pushed out mom-and-pop shops, now the communities have lost convenience as well as property and sales tax revenue. Some see this, though, as an opportunity to revitalize Main Street, but others are not so optimistic. For our Illinois Issues report this week, Daisy Contreras explores what it means when Walmart leaves town.
Were you born in Pena?
Yes, I was born in Pena.
It's a sunny, cold day in December, and I'm walking with 73-year-old Glenn Schneider toward an empty parking lot where a large vacant building now stands.
A year ago, there would have probably been at least 50 cars in that parking lot.
The building housed a Walmart where Schneider worked maintenance for 17 years. Pena is located about 40 miles south of Springfield and was once a bustling community. A century ago, it had large coal-powered greenhouses growing roses, serving as a distribution center for the rest of the country. That's how it got the name City of Roses. But the town has since gone through many changes. The greenhouses shut down and the coal mines closed. Today, the town has a population of 5,700. And 2 months ago, the town took another blow after their 35-year-old Walmart store closed its doors. Schneider says the town is still dealing with the aftermath.
It was just so handy. You could go there, you could buy nuts, bolts, tape, school supplies. They just had a variety of everything in one store.
Pena was not alone. A Walmart in Clinton, another town in central Illinois between Decatur and Bloomington, also suffered the same fate over the summer. Clinton had the smallest Walmart store in the state. Experts say the retail closures are only a symptom of bigger issues taking place in the rural Midwest: declining population, aging baby boomers, and rising poverty rates. Some local town officials, however, see the closures as an opportunity to revitalize their small cities and wean residents off Walmart convenience. When the Walmart moved into Pena in 1983, local businesses could not compete. One glaring example: Pena had 3 independently owned pharmacies in the 80s, but those were forced to close.
And so Walmart really changed the small town landscape, business landscape, Main Street landscape, as it were.
That's Chris Merritt, director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University.
And so now when these stores are, when Walmart's closed shop, there is really a void, if you will, because many of those mom-and-pop shops that were there 40 and 50 years ago are no longer there. Walmart leaves, and so there's this emptiness.
Pena's mayor, Donald Kroski, says Walmart's decision was abrupt.
The reason they gave me on a phone call was this store did not fit the image of the future Walmarts. I call them the mega Walmarts, the big ones, and that's what they want.
Merritt says he believes retail closures will continue, especially if small rural towns can't keep up with the online shopping trends, forcing brick-and-mortar stores to reevaluate their business strategies. Most, if not all, are competing with Amazon's lucrative model. Merritt says the state needs to tackle issues of population loss and aging residents who have less money to spend after retirement.
It sounds like it's a big, lofty discussion far afield from Walmart, but the issue of small-town Walmart's closing is a symptom of a deeper demographic problem in downstate Illinois.
Walmart did not respond to a request for comment on whether they had future plans to close stores in rural communities. But Pena's mayor says without Walmart as a competitor, this could be an opportunity for his town to return to more independently owned businesses. David Falk also saw that opportunity. His family operated a Save More pharmacy in town for years. Now he's made a proposal to reopen the business.
And when Walmart came to town, it was too many pharmacies in a small town, and we couldn't make it. So we closed up shop and left. And Pena was good to us when we were there before, so we thought we'd come back and try it again.
But Chris Merritt, who studies rural issues, is not as optimistic about a resurgence for small business.
There will come a point where even Dollar General will retreat. The question of retail on Main Street, rural Illinois, is a question about retail trade in a general sense, but it's also about demographics.
Back in Pena, the looming Walmart sign is gone, and the building remains empty. Glenn Schneider, the former Walmart maintenance worker, who also serves as a Pena alderman, says he'll be pushing to help revitalize downtown.
Yeah, we'll survive. I'm not afraid of that.
I'm Daisy Contreras.
Read more of Daisy's coverage on this topic. It's available at our website, statewideshow.com. The recent climate change report issued by the National Climate Assessment detailed the many ways climate change is already impacting our daily lives and the increasing effects we may experience right here in the Midwest. Reporter Jacqueline Driscoll spoke with Don Fullerton. He's a government and public affairs professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He says we need to start making changes, and it starts with policymakers.
Don, thanks so much for joining me. I want to dive right in. This was a massive report, but I want to focus on the section specifically discussing the Midwest. First, since it is such an important economic factor in our area, agriculture, how might our farmers and their crops be impacted by climate change?
Agriculture could be affected a number of different ways. With global warming and climate change, there could be changes in the patterns of pests, for example. The temperature will affect which pests might become more common or less common, and so that might cause some damage to crops. But even more so, the change in temperature will affect which crops are most likely to be most productive, and so farmers might have to change the variety of certain things that they grow. And then thirdly, climate change comes with more frequent and more severe storms, and in fact, more extremes of all sorts, more droughts and more floods, which is kind of strange, but that could be the most disruptive. In the spring, when the farmers are trying to plant, is the time that we're likely to get extra rain in Illinois, and that causes a problem with planting because farmers are waiting for the rain to stop so that they can plant. And so the timing on the planting gets screwed up, and it might cause problems with growing crops with extra rain in the spring. And then we'll have less rain in the summer. We'll have droughts during the summer, and that, of course, causes a problem. Illinois rainfall has been very steady for forever, and so very few farmers have any need for irrigation. They don't spray water because it rains every week in Illinois, even throughout the summer. And if that changes, then we don't have the irrigation infrastructure to make up for that.
Farmers have been adapting to a changing climate for centuries. They already see longer growing seasons than others did just a few decades ago. So can farmers simply adapt to these changes?
Yes, farmers are smart, and there are great technologies out there. So yes, they can adapt, well, especially if they know it's coming. And so, you know, within a few years, they can get the right equipment or the right fertilizer or plant the right crop. And so I'm sure there's experts that can predict to a certain extent how the farmers should start now to adapt. But the problem is, again, the uncertainty. There will be some shocks to the system. You know, a big storm comes at an unexpected time, could wash away an entire planting season. So if you know when the storms are coming, you could act accordingly. Or if you know how hot it's going to get and when it's going to get hotter, you could plant a different variety of crops. But the whole problem here is the high degree of unpredictability.
You've talked about major weather events, droughts and floods, specifically here in the Midwest. These natural disasters are not only scary to think about, but they're extremely costly when they do happen. So can you speak to the financial damage we may see as climate change does continue?
Yes, well, there's two kinds of costs, and we'll get hit with both of them. You know, One is the cost of adaptation. So, for example, the city of Chicago is preparing to at least some extent for bigger future storms by renovating and rebuilding an entire storm drainage system. Of course, you need to be able to get the drain system to run the water out of the city so it doesn't flood. I mean, when the rain comes down, the better storm drainage system you have, the more damage can be averted, including, you know, deaths and drowning and who knows what kinds of accidents and other damage could be caused by a flood. So we can prepare for that, but it's expensive. So that's one major cost, is the cost of that kind of adaptation. But then almost no matter how much of that you do, when the storm comes, there's going to be some damage. And of course, if you don't adapt, there'll be more damage. But even if you do that kind of investment, there will be some damage. And that's another cost we will have to bear, you know, because the storms will be more extreme than they have been recently. And so there will be some flooding and people will get caught in the floods. And there will be deaths, as there is in flooding, you know, all along the Gulf of Mexico when there's a hurricane. You know, you always hear reports of how many people died because of flooding. And there will be damage to buildings, as you also hear about in around the Gulf of Mexico after a hurricane, because when there was floods in these various houses, basically, you know, the water damage is severe and the house has to be completely rebuilt.
Maybe this is a little damning to think about, but are these massive floods, these droughts, other impacts, are they inevitable or can we stop them?
It's not either or. It's a matter of degree. Yes, it's inevitable. To at least some degree. If we do nothing about it, it will be much worse. Even if we do something about it, we might be able to reduce the damages, but there still will be storms that are worse than they were before. And so, because we're already well into climate change, because the climate is already changing and there's already loads and loads of extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So we're going to be facing these climate damages for decades now. It's too late to reverse that completely. But we could slow it down, and we could adapt.
I'm speaking with Don Fullerton, a professor at the U of I, about the inevitable, as we just heard, impacts of climate change. You mentioned we could slow those effects down if we do something about it. You also completed your own report about preparing for climate change in Illinois, where you answer many questions, specifically the we in who should be doing something about it. So, who is it? Is it you and me? Is it the policymakers? All of the above?
Well, it's all of the above, but primarily I think the policymakers. Adaptation means mostly government planning, and that can be at a local level. City of Chicago needs storm drains. They need better transportation networks. They need health facilities for the coming heat waves. The state of Illinois needs to help the farmers and maybe irrigation if there's going to be droughts. You know, so that's at a local level is adaptation. But then at a national level, there's more need for a national policy to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. That can be in conjunction with other nations because the emissions worldwide, all around the globe, will affect the degree of future climate change.
How can we start initiating these changes right here in Illinois, but specifically regarding policy changes, and do we need to?
The state of Illinois emits well under 1% of worldwide carbon dioxide emissions. So in a sense, it's just a drop in the bucket because we need China to reduce emissions and India and all the other states in the U.S. and all of Europe, et cetera. But on the other hand, I think it's quite important that states like California do have a climate policy. They have a cap and trade for carbon dioxide emissions. And what's important about it is the demonstration effect. They're basically telling the world, we're not going to sit around waiting. We got to start now, and we got to start somewhere. So we might as well start at the local level. And you can start at home. You know, you can get a more efficient car or drive it less and use less gasoline. You can turn out the lights when you leave the room so that you're burning less electricity. And everybody can do that. And then, of course, the government can help people do that, or they can require people to do that. You know, there are various environmental policies to reduce emissions and to encourage or require greater energy efficiency on appliances and vehicles. But there's an important demonstration effect. You can demonstrate to your neighbors, and the state of Illinois can demonstrate to its neighbors in the same way that the state of California has demonstrated to its neighbors that we got to get going, and here's how to do it. And then we can study that and see how it works. And then it can be adopted by other states, and then that can be adopted by other countries.
On the subject of policy and policymakers, we will soon have a new governor sworn in. We have several new state representatives and senators. If you could make them a list of priorities specifically dealing with climate change and its effects, what would you say should be at the top of that list?
You know, I have talked a little bit to legislators in Springfield about issues about climate change and climate policy and adaptation and, you know, reducing emissions. And their primary concern is about coal jobs in Illinois. They need to keep the voters happy. I certainly understand that. So I don't blame them for worrying about coal jobs. But I guess I would emphasize that those coal jobs are on the way out anyhow, in a manner that has nothing to do with climate change. Coal is just not economically advantageous or even feasible anymore. Natural gas is cheaper because of the new fracking boom, and just easier and cheaper to find and to extract natural gas, which is less carbon per kilowatt hour in electricity generation. And so the coal is just not economic. And those jobs are going to be lost anyway. So if you're worried about those people, the thing to do is to facilitate their change, their relocation and retraining, because coal is on the way out, period. You cannot effectively preserve those coal jobs because we'd be paying them to do something that's just not productive to do, not economic. It's not an efficient industry. We need to get different sources of electricity and newer technologies.
U of I Professor Don Fullerton talking with our Jacqueline Driscoll. Stay with us on Statewide. Coming up next, why most Illinois colleges and universities have yet to ban the box. That story on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll hear about a call for schools to do more to help victims of sexual assault. A reminder, you can find us each week on the website statewideshow.com. Our past episodes are there. You can also contact us through the site. Just drop us a line, let us know what you're thinking. Next year, the common application used by hundreds of colleges and universities will stop asking potential students about their criminal histories. But despite legislative efforts in Illinois, most campuses here in the state continue to ask the question. And as Lee Gaines reports, just seeing that question on a college application can discourage people with criminal records from even applying for college.
4 years ago, Chris Miner sat down at his computer and started his application to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And that's when he saw the question. It asked if he had a criminal record.
This is all done online, and I just sit there and stared at the screen for like 10 minutes. It was like every advancement I made so far might be over with. Maybe this is the end of the ride.
So, Miner lied on the application, and he was accepted. He didn't disclose the fact that in the early 2000s, he was arrested, convicted, and sent to prison for stealing thousands of dollars from a Domino's pizza he worked for. Once Miner started at the U of I, he opened up about his past. He started speaking in public about it and volunteering with organizations that help formerly incarcerated people. Then he decided to apply for a graduate degree at the U of I.
So I'm filling the application. Of course, it's late at nights when I do my best work. And then I came across the question. And yeah, there were tears. I cried. But it was upsetting because I have achieved this at your university. I've given you money. I was on the dean's list every semester I've been there. I graduated. And you're still going to ask me this? You're going to ask anyone this?
This time, Miner was honest about his record, and he was accepted again. But there's a lot of people who don't get as far as Miner did. A 2015 study found that an estimated two-thirds of people with felony convictions who started applications to the State University of New York dropped out of the application process in part because of having to provide information about their criminal records.
There's no evidence that says because Illinois asks these questions that we're safer.
That's Barbara Wheeler. She's a conservative Republican in Illinois' House of Representatives who's tried for the past 3 years to pass legislation that would prevent public universities and colleges from asking the question. So, what's getting in the way? While she's managed to pass it in the House, the bill has stalled in the Senate, and that's largely because nearly every public university in the state opposes the legislation. Despite Wheeler's assertions, Aaron Woodruff says the bill is a threat to student safety. He's the campus police chief for Illinois State University.
Specifically in the areas of sexual violence, my major concern with this bill is that we cannot prevent somebody who's been accused, convicted of sexual assault at another institution. That individual could then apply to ISU or to any of these institutions, not have to disclose that, and the university can't use that information to prevent that individual from attending.
There's not a lot of research on this, but what's out there tends to support Wheeler, the state lawmaker. There's no conclusive evidence to suggest that asking about an individual's criminal history during the admissions process decreases campus crime. Wheeler said she's also heard the concern about sexual violence from parents in her district.
I have four daughters, and I hope all of them go through the state program. And I, of course, if I thought for a second that my children would be in danger because of what I'm doing, do you think I would really do it? Of course I wouldn't.
Proponents of banning the box on college applications say the question is doing more harm than good, and the impact is especially profound for people of color. Because blacks are disproportionately represented in prisons, they're also disproportionately affected by policies that ask about criminal records. That's something Chris Miner worries about. He's the formerly incarcerated student at the U of I, and he's also white.
As soon as I got in, I was elated, but not long after, it's like, well, how many people didn't go through with this process? Or did other people, you know, maybe a different color or a different background, did they mark the same answer as I did and get rejected? It's still ridiculous, and that's why I'm still fighting against them, and hopefully that question won't be around much longer.
Proponents of the legislation say they're going to continue the fight, too. They say they'll renew their effort to ban the box on college applications after the state's new Democratic governor, J.B. Pritzker, takes office. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
That story produced with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. A new report says Illinois needs comprehensive guidelines when it comes to dealing with sexual misconduct cases in kindergarten through high schools. Wendy Pollack heads the Women's Law and Policy Initiative of the Sergeant Shriver National Center on Poverty Law and wrote the report. Rachel Otwell spoke with Pollack to learn more about her findings.
What's important is to be clear to students and parents and guardians and faculty what the school will do. The point is that there needs to be clear, transparent, written policies so everybody understands what the process is, what the procedure is, how the student's information will be handled in a confidential manner. This is a problem throughout the state. We know that, and that's what this report addresses. It's not just a Chicago Public Schools problem. It's throughout the state. And what our report showed, we had focus groups and one-on-one interviews with both students and service providers and some in-school social workers around the state, in every part of the state. And this is a problem. And the lack of these written policies, lack of any kind of real protocol, that when a school actually did an okay job, it was more because there was just someone in the know, kind of a luck of the draw kind of thing, not because there was policies and protocols in place that would really protect the students.
And we're hearing on the federal level about proposed changes to Title IX implementation. Title IX is meant to prevent gender discrimination in schools, including primary and high schools, which actually ends up meaning a lot of different things. Any thoughts on how those possible changes could affect what we're talking about?
The proposed regulations are not good. They really roll back some of the protections that the survivors have now. So, for example, schools wouldn't be obligated to really do anything for students if the violence happened off campus. And the reality is, while there's unfortunately a large number of on-campus incidents, the majority of incidents actually happen off campus. If you're talking about the college level, you know, you could have something happen at a frat party between students and the school doesn't have responsibility. So there's lots of things in the proposed regulations that are really not good. So what I would hope is that here in Illinois and in other states, that we step up and not let those kinds of things happen, because the reality is, whether or not the violence lives up to any kind of legal definition to prove a case in court, the reality is this incident happened. The survivor is often traumatized and needs help, both in terms of counseling and in terms of being able to stay in school and complete their education successfully.
I'm Rachel Otwell, and I'm speaking with Wendy Pollack, who heads the Women's Law and Policy Initiative of the Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law in Chicago. She helped author a report just out that details the accounts of students in K-12 schools in Illinois who have dealt with sexual harassment and assault. She suggested I also call up Elisa Hill, now a student at Northern Illinois University. Hill says she went to a Chicago high school and had an inappropriate experience with a teacher during her time there. We're going to listen now to some more of what she had to say.
I was in his office by myself. I think we were discussing my detention. At the time, I was working at a restaurant in like a suburb outside of Chicago. And I knew I couldn't serve the detention because I needed to go to work. So I indicated to him that, you know, is there any way that I can serve the this detention another day? Like, I really can't afford to miss work. He began to, like, question, like, my work. And, you know, he told me, I want to come to your job. I want to see you. I want you to serve me. I don't live too far from there. What is your number? I was just, like, shocked at this was taking place.
Hill says she went to an administrator with other female students who had said the teacher had been inappropriate with them, and within days, he was gone from the school. But Hill says no one followed up with her, and she was worried he might come after her.
I really just want to know, where is he, and how can I, as a survivor, move on from this knowing that proper decisions were made to ensure that this person won't ever do this destruction again?
Hill says the experience has inspired her to be an advocate for sexual harassment and abuse survivors. And so back to the report, it mentions what's happened in the wake of Me Too, a movement that some would say is still ongoing, and how this has created more public conversations and policies, in some cases, addressing sexual violence. But you talk about the lack of attention when it comes to children.
There's a lot of challenges when it comes to children and youth. So that's why we have focused for so many years on elementary and secondary students, because there's never been much attention paid to that group. This is a problem that's existed probably forever. Even with the Me Too movement, and we're talking about adults, there's a lot of victim blaming and there's a lot of just not believing people. And I think that that is exasperated for children and youth.
And so the report identifies a few themes in particular that I take it were reoccurring issues that came up in your interviews. One had to do with confidentiality. Tell us about your findings regarding that.
I mean, this is a real problem, and it really will discourage anybody from coming forward. I mean, the students have stories from they're aware that teachers are talking about it amongst themselves, and it becomes obvious. You know, we even had an example of teachers coming up to a student asking her how she was. You know, for those who pay attention of what's happened at the Chicago schools, they have now set up this hotline for people to report, you know, gender-based violence, and they had 600 reports, and people were like, wow, that's 600 reports. There's more than 600 schools in Chicago Public Schools. I mean, that's like less than one call per school. To me, there should be thousands more. So if you have a system where people, survivors, feel comfortable coming forward, they'll come forward. And now what we have to see is if the system they build is really something that will protect the students' confidentiality, really be a help to them and not a hindrance to their educational development. For gender-based violence survivors, we often talk about safety plans. What students need are safety plans plus education plans. So, you know, we've called them in the past student success plans. It's like, what is needed to keep someone safe? So if it's making sure they're not in the same class, what I've seen, particularly in smaller, more rural areas and smaller towns, is a lot of what I call involuntary homeschooling going on, which means that the parents felt like they had no choice but to take their child out of school because the school administrators were just not doing anything. They felt that their child's safety was at risk. And I remember even talking to a parent who had to take not just the survivor, the student had been sexually assaulted out of school, but had to take her siblings out of school too because they were being bullied because of what was going on. I think there needs to be more leeway in transferring schools. That's often difficult in, you know, more rural areas of the state, but there has to be a way to make sure that the survivors can stay in school and be safe.
Wendy Pollack of Chicago's Shriver Center. Our website, statewideshow.com, has a link to their report on how schools support or fail in supporting sexual assault survivors in schools right here in Illinois. And Rachel Lotwell now joins us with some exciting news. Rachel, you've been selected for a new collaboration, a reporting collaboration. Can you explain what's going to be taking place?
I had joined the Illinois Newsroom this year, which is a regional journalism collaborative. Mary Hansen, who is also an NPR Illinois reporter, is on that as well. And with them, I will be joining ProPublica and their local reporting network. This is the second year that they solicited pitches from various newsrooms. They apparently got over 200 applications, and they picked 14.
Let's talk about the topic you're going to be addressing and what you hope to achieve with that.
So Christine Herman and I did a report looking at a couple different professors. One had retired from Lincoln Land Community College in Springfield this year. Jake Hasen at the U of I has been all over the news, and he has the latest on that I can tell is that he's decided to take a year-long voluntary sabbatical. But we reported on the misconduct allegations against both of those professors. In Gary Swee's case, who I looked into, there were 20 years or so of various reports about sexual harassment. So my question really was how did that go on that long and get to a point where he just kind of quietly resigned after a seventh official allegation came to light, and they apparently were going to really start moving for him to be fired. He was able to just kind of leave. So we're looking at similar cases across the state.
So the problem seems to be much larger because we're hearing all of these instances and yet we're not seeing a lot of reporting about it necessarily. So that's what you're hoping to correct here.
Yeah, I think when there are cases, you know, they definitely, I've heard from some people saying, oh, isn't this issue overdone even? Because we do hear from time to time about, we certainly hear regularly about sexual harassment and, you know, rape on college campuses between students, especially. Students at the University of Chicago recently had a hearing, their own sort of student-led conference about sexual misconduct on college campuses in regards to Title IX rollbacks that are expected. And so that's making the issue more urgent. And there were, you know, two cases out of Peoria that were somewhat related over the past month or two. It just seems like the more we look into this, the more we hear from people. I have, you know, names I'll be looking into already. And I'm really hoping over the next year to just be building trust with our sources and finding more of those sources and, you know, letting them know that there's somebody who's willing to listen when in the past maybe they couldn't really find someone to amplify their voice. By the way, on that note, if you have any information at all that you want to share, you can reach me at Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L, at ilnewsroom.org.
Thanks, Rachel. We look forward to hearing your reporting in 2019 right here on Statewide.
Thanks, Sean.
Now, Next, we'll get an update on a clergy abuse investigation in the state of Illinois. Still to come here on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, a retail expert will join us to talk about the challenges facing many communities.
Stories like Toys R Us, you know, shuttering hundreds and hundreds of locations. You see Kmart and Sears closing. And so that creates concern for city leaders.
We'll also hear about some possible bright spots in retail. That's still ahead. But now, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan has been investigating each of Illinois' six Roman Catholic dioceses since August, after a Pennsylvania grand jury report revealed the scope of child sexual abuse committed by Catholic priests there. Madigan says Illinois dioceses have been cooperative so far. Four of them have published the names of priests with credible abuse allegations against them, and more names are expected to be released. Our Sam Dunklaw got in touch with the Attorney General this week. She told him her office may seek to prosecute the church if it's warranted.
Can you kind of reiterate for me what sort of the aim with this whole investigation is?
Sure. So in the aftermath of the Pennsylvania grand jury report coming out about the extensive abuse of children that had taken place in their diocese, I recognize that there was really a pattern in practice that was taking place, and there were at least seven clergy members who had at some point had contact with the state of Illinois, either being moved here or just coming here. And so we first and foremost wanted to identify what had taken place with those individuals, whether there were any allegations against them here in the state of Illinois, but we also wanted to make sure that the Catholic diocese here in Illinois had fully and completely revealed any sexual abuse of minors that had taken place with clergy here. We are still at the beginning stages of our investigation, and so we are reviewing the files. And one of the things that the diocese have done as part of our investigation is to start to publish the lists of names of clergy members with credible allegations of abuse against minors. But there is far more information for us to go through, and I think there'll be far more information that needs to be made public to parishioners as well. And I also think you can anticipate that there will be more names of clergy that will be released on the basis of our investigation.
One of the church officials I've talked to on this has said that the financial burden that comes from legal action when it comes to this sort of thing has put a financial strain on the church. What do you say to things like that?
Well, I think that response is reprehensible. The reality is that the actions, the criminal actions of Catholic clergy members have ruined people's lives, and not just those individuals who were children at the time, but their entire families. And the Catholic Church has to take full responsibility for what it's done, and they need to come clean, and they need to put in place better procedures to ensure that these types of crimes never happen again, and that's one of the reasons that we're going to pursue this investigation.
What specifically would you like changed from a legal standpoint, from a spiritual leadership standpoint when it comes to this sort of thing? And from what you've seen of what policies are in place in some of these dioceses, is it enough?
Well, we're working on that. One of the things we've already found is that there really is no protocol when it comes to dealing with these matters. And so each diocese handles things a little bit differently. Certainly, we're concerned about making sure that there are best practices that are followed in terms of prevention, in terms of investigation, in terms of reporting. But one of the things I would say is that it's become clear that the Catholic Church cannot handle these matters internally. They can't handle these matters as personnel matters. Crimes were committed, and for decades, the Catholic Church was hiding these, was in many ways discrediting the victims and their families. They have improved since the early 2000s, but, you know, based on the people that are coming to us, there is still a lot of work to do.
You mentioned that this investigation is preliminary at the moment, but what is the office looking to do as you move forward?
Well, as I said, we still have an enormous amount of information to review from the diocese, so we will continue on in that. We're also looking at making sure that there are best practices put in place and hopefully a standard protocol put in place in terms of prevention and investigation and reporting. And it may be that there are some circumstances under which criminal prosecution will be warranted. But, you know, the goal here is to ensure a full and complete accounting to the victims and parishioners and the public.
That's Attorney General Lisa Madigan talking with reporter Sam Dunklaw about her office's ongoing investigation of Illinois' Roman Catholic Church. This week, lawmakers in Congress passed the Farm Bill, sending the nearly $870 billion legislation to President Trump. The Farm Bill lays out, among other things, policies to feed hungry families in the U.S., subsidies for farmers, and programs to improve soil and water. Grant Gerlach with Harvest Public Media explains what made the cuts and what did not.
One of the biggest fights over the huge farm bill had nothing at all to do with farmers. It was about the largest budget item in the bill, the food stamp program, also known as SNAP. House Republicans wanted to double the number of people required to work in order to stay in SNAP. Senate Democrats vowed to block that proposal. The standoff lasted for months. But when the midterms flipped the House, it forced the issue. This morning, House Speaker Paul Ryan endorsed the compromise.
This bill strengthens work requirements and boosts work supports so that more people are spurred toward opportunities.
That makes it sound like the House proposal is in the bill, but it's not. There is extra money for training programs, but the work requirements were dropped to clear the way for the bill to pass. And that's how it is with much of the Farm Bill. It makes incremental changes, not structural reforms. That goes for SNAP and forestry, which leaves out most last-minute demands made by the White House to fast-track forest thinning projects. Some describe this as a status quo bill. It even costs about the same. But Julie Obadzinski of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition says there are significant changes. She points to what she calls tiny but mighty programs that the Farm Bill would make permanent, things like outreach to minority and veteran farmers and training for new farmers.
We know that these issues, they're not temporary issues, especially the aging farm population and where the next generation of farmers are going to come from.
The Farm Bill would more than double research funding for organic farming, and it legalizes hemp for industrial products and medicinal CBD oil, something many farmers hope will become a new lucrative cash crop. Up to now, only a handful were able to grow it under tight regulations. John Currier farms in the Imperial Valley of Southern California, where four generations of his family have grown winter vegetables like cauliflower, lettuce, and broccoli. He now wants to swap those veggies for hemp because he says he can't keep up with farm consolidation.
I mean, the writing's on the wall that unless you're a big corporate farmer that's year-round in the produce business, you pretty much got to get out of it.
In the Farm Bill, states can allow hemp production as long as the crop contains less than 0.3% of THC, the compound in marijuana that causes the high. Aspiring hemp farmers like Currier would even be eligible for crop insurance.
I need something else to grow. I mean, this hemp deal's kind of fallen in our lap at the exact perfect time.
Now, a new bill is headed to President Trump's desk, 2.5 months after the current Farm Bill expired.
And it always goes back to politics, and I hate politics. Most farmers do.
That's Mark Nelson, who raises corn, soybeans, and cattle near Paola, Kansas. Like a lot of farmers, Nelson has been working against a headwind. The trade fight with China has spoiled soybean prices, and on top of that, a drought crashed crop yields. He says crop insurance subsidies, which are mostly unchanged in the Farm Bill, help him avoid a critical financial blow.
And that's what's important for most farmers, is just get me to next year. We know we're going to have our ups and downs. We're going to have years where we don't produce, and crop insurance helps us with our lenders and banks, and that's all tied to the Farm Bill.
A bill that's years in the making and crucial for the people who grow the food we eat. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Illinois continues to see big box stores close, and that means lost jobs, often empty store space. Still, Joe Fackel with the Canvas Group says he's optimistic about the future of retail. The city of Springfield recently hired him to look at vacant shopping space in the capital city. And Mary Hansen talked with Fackel about the trends he's seeing.
If you pick up a newspaper or you hop on any news website any day of the week, you see stories like Toys R Us, shuttering hundreds and hundreds of locations. You see Kmart and Sears closing. And so that creates concern for city leaders who rely on those retailers to drive local option sales tax. So from an economic development standpoint, retail is critically important to the city of Springfield and every other city in Illinois that that lives and dies on local option sales tax. And so what we're trying to do is look at the market objectively, honestly, and identify sites and opportunities where we think there's development or redevelopment possibilities.
What are some of the challenges that you see here in Springfield in terms of retail space?
Well, the challenge for every city in the Midwest is perception. The perception that you've got declining population bases, you've got people leaving in droves, and those perceptions more often than not are not based in any kind of reality. So you're competing with not only Peoria right down the road or St. Louis, you're also competing with rapidly growing cities in the Sun Belt. Retailers see that, and they know that those high growth markets represent really good opportunities to expand their operations. That doesn't mean that Springfield's not a great place to locate. It just means that you got to sell it a little bit harder. It might take a little bit longer to have those retailers see the light.
When you visited Springfield around that time, Kmart announced that it was closing its Springfield store out on Clear Lake. What do you see as the potential future for a building like that?
There's no single tenant that's going to backfill a vacant Kmart. At least I haven't seen one that is a retailer that's generating sales tax and property tax. You know, the cold, hard reality of that is there are vacant Kmart boxes littering the countryside, and some of them have been vacant for 30 years. You know, so it takes an enterprising property owner or developer. It is likely going to take public participation to finance the redevelopment of that in some form or fashion. And it's going to take a couple of retail or several retail tenants that find that site attractive in order to re-tenant that.
What do you expect to see in Springfield in the next 5 years?
The retailers that are really growing and expanding today are in the restaurant space. So the fast casual restaurant players, I think those are going to continue to grow. And a lot of those are not in Springfield yet, but they will be. I think the low-hanging fruit is on the restaurant side. If you look at White Oaks Mall, what a lot of traditional enclosed regional malls have done, and I don't know whether or not this is in the plans for White Oaks, but adding a housing component. If you look at a lot of shopping centers on the West Coast, you'll see multifamily developments literally connected to a shopping mall. I think the fact that the healthcare in and around Springfield, especially downtown, how that's growing and expanding, you're going to see, young professionals wanting to move in and live downtown, shop downtown, work downtown. And in order to facilitate that kind of development, you've got to have amenities. And at the end of the day, brick and mortar retail is an amenity. But those are some of the things that we're seeing. There's a lot of positive that's going to happen once this kind of retail correction is over and people are really looking to expand rapidly. I think Springfield's going to be a good place to land.
Joe Fackel is president of the Canvas Group. He talked with our reporter, Mary Hansen. That that will do it for this week. Thanks for being with us for another Statewide. Join us again next time. A reminder, you can find all our episodes, including this one, at statewideshow.com. Also find our podcast at NPR One. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.